happy to have Jerome Gauntlet tell us about that title.
Yeah, geometric extremization for SUSY ADS-CFT.
Thanks, Tom. And thank you to the organizers for the opportunity to speak. I've been thoroughly enjoying this workshop, learning many new things. Based on the talks I've heard over the last 2.5 weeks, if you see this title, you might think that I'll be extremizing HRT surfaces. Or this will be an HRT surface-free talk. There's still things that are interesting to extremize outside of that context. So what I want to talk about is a class of ADS2 solutions of D equals 11 and a class of ADS3 solutions of type 2B. So here is the metric on ADS2 space, and here is a 9-dimensional Riemannian manifold. D is a scalar field that depends on the Y9. This is a warp compactification. And the four-form flux is volume of ADS2, wedge of two form. And similarly for the 2B case, it's a warp product of ADS3 cross Y7. And the five-form is volume of ADS3, wedge F2. So these are dual to supersymmetric conformal quantum mechanics. And I'll be interested in having two superchargers. And in particular, there's an R symmetry, which rotates those two superchargers. And here, this will be dual to a D equals 2 supersymmetric conformal field theory. And I'll demand that it's dual to the supersymmetry has chiral 0,2 comma supersymmetry. So again, there's an R symmetry.
The transverse space is non-compact.
Y9 and Y7 are compact.
They're compact.
So the data, and at this stage, it's completely unclear why there'd be anything between these two, its similarity. But the data of an odd-dimensional manifold, a metric, a scalar field, and a two-form is what I'm interested in. And we'll see, as I'll show you, that they are part of an infinite family. And that two-form is closed.
So B, the warp factoring...
Yeah, B unfortunately is a scalar field. It's not a two-form.
But it's going to vary, right?
Yes. So this has all the isometries of ADS2 and ADS3, which is what you need to get a dual field theory. Okay. And remarkably, there's a very rich set of solutions, both in this class and this class. They're not one of the most general solutions I could have written down. It's particularly obvious in this context because I haven't added any Nevershort 3 form, or the axion, or dilaton, or the Ramond-Ramond 3 form. So I'm setting those to zero. And here, this might look like it's the most general thing, but I've only got electric 4-form flux. In principle, I could add in a magnetic 4-form flux, which was just lying along those, but I'm not doing that. Interesting things to think about, but this is already a very rich story in itself. There's many, many explicit solutions of this form that you can write down in completely explicit form. And the goal of the program is to understand the geometries in more detail and then identify the dual conformal field theories. Just a little bit of history. I've been thinking about this for about 15 years. It started with two very nice papers by Naku Kim, an old postdoc of mine, and his student Park, who first identified these kinds of geometries. And then shortly after, Naku and I worked out what was really going on with the geometry and seeing that it generalizes to arbitrary odd dimensions. And then about that time, in 4 papers with various collaborators, which I won't mention, we constructed explicit solutions, and I'll give you a feeling for how you can do that, but I won't be the focus of the talk. And then pretty much nothing happened for 10 years. And nothing happened in terms of identifying the dual field theories. And I'll give you an idea of why that was. And then what I'll be talking about is work with my collaborators Dario Martelli and James Sparks in 4 papers, and one of them, Chris Cousins, appeared. So this is interesting in itself.
Can you do this for ADS4 plus a 7?
Great question, Gary. I'm just about to tell you more about that. So there's a parallel story, and it will also give you extra motivation for being interested, particularly in this class at this conference. So the parallel story, which is very well established, but maybe not all of you here, is that there's ADS4 across the Sasaki-Einstein 7 solutions of D equals 11. Definition of the Sasaki-Einstein manifold is that the cone metric is Clabial, complex, Kähler, and Ricci flat. So these solutions come from taking membranes and putting at the apex of a Clabial cone. And when you go in and look at the near horizon limit, you get this B-couple theory, which is dual to the conformal field theory in three dimensions with n equals 2 supersymmetry. And there's even better understood examples where you take D3 brains in 2B and you put them at the apex of a Clabial 3 cone, the cross-section is the Sasaki-Einstein 5, and this is dual to an n equals 1 conformal field theory in 4 dimensions. One thing that's going to be important is all of the theories I've written down have an R-symmetry. So any 4-dimensional conformal field theory with n equals 1 supersymmetry has an R-symmetry. This has an R-symmetry as well, which rotates the two supercharges. Geometrically, the R-symmetry comes canonically from this description. So I told you that this is a Clabial metric it's a cone metric. So there's a canonical vector, d by dr. And if you hit that with a complex structure, it's a complex manifold, you get another vector. Maybe I should write it like that. Jij, d by dr, j. That will give you another vector. That vector is a killing vector. So it's a canonical killing vector, which you knew you must have, because the field theory has this n equals 2 symmetry with an R symmetry, so this had to have a killing vector. So both of these spaces have a killing vector. And similarly, these spaces here have killing vectors as well. Okay, so just to motivate this slightly more, let's imagine, this story, there's many things known about that. There's infinite class of explicit solutions, the field theories are known, there's a very well-known story here. Let's imagine we started with one of these examples. So we start with ADS4, that's dual to an n equals 2, d equals 3, conformal field theory. And then I put the field theory on a Riemann surface. So typically that will break supersymmetry, but if you add in a suitable twist, which means adding in R-symmetry background fields, you can preserve supersymmetry. And actually, you can also add in extra, if you have extra global symmetries, this field theory has extra global symmetries, you can twist by those global symmetries as well. So you put it on a Riemann surface, and then you flow to the infrared, and you'll get, it turns out, the supersymmetric quantum mechanics with n equals 2 supersymmetry. And let's imagine, it's not given, but that goes to a conformal, it becomes conformally invariant. So it's a conformally invariant quantum mechanics. Well, if that happens, that will be dual to an ADS2 across Y9. And the way in which I've set this up, the Y9 will be a vibration of the Sasaki-Einstein 7 space over the Riemann surface. And if this flow is happening in the field theory, that means there is a solution that looks like ADS4 across the Sasaki-Einstein 7 in the UV, and ADS2 across Y9 in the infrared, where Y9 is of this form. And this twisting means that there's magnetic charge on the Riemann surface. And if you think about that for a moment, that's a black hole. So one motivation for thinking, the principal motivation for thinking about these ADS2 solutions cost Y9 is this particular subclass. When the Y9 is a fibration of a Riemann surface, they are the near horizon limits of black holes. From this side, if we can calculate the two-dimensional Newton's constant, the surface area of the black hole, and you can count the ground states of this conformal quantum mechanics, then you've obtained a microscopic state counting interpretation of the black hole entropy. So if one can pursue this, get a number here, geometrically, you've got your black hole, you can produce that number, and you can match them, then in the large n limit, you've made a microscopic state counting interpretation of black hole entropy for asymptotically ADS black holes. So that's a main motivation for thinking about these solutions. The same thing applies if you take ADS5 Kostosaki Einstein 5 and you take the D equals 4 field theory, you put it on a Riemann surface, and then you'll get down to a theory in two dimensions. And if that flows to a 0,2 conformal field theory, that will be dual to an ADS3 cross Y7. And we have magnetic charge on the Riemann surface. And the Y7 here is a fibration of this form. So this subclass is a particularly interesting class of the more general story, because it has connections to black hole, asymptotically ADS4, and black strings, asymptotically ADS5. So let me just pause to see if there's any questions about this.
A general question.
Yeah.
How do we know that if we have any equal to supersymmetry, we should have a Killing vector? Could it be that the...
Over here?
Yeah, could it be that that symmetry is realized in terms of, for example, Nipper and charge or some plate field?
I think if you have n equals 2, there's necessarily an SO2 that will rotate the two charges, right?
Yes.
So that's the R symmetry. And then I think if you have the superconformal algebra, it necessarily will appear in the commutator with S to S.
What you're saying is the Killing vector couldn't be charged could not carry the Riemann charge, for example.
So I think from the field theory point of view, this necessarily has an R symmetry. I think that's a given.
Yes.
So if that's going to be realized, so you're saying does it necessarily have to have a Killing vector to realize the R symmetry? Is that the
right.
question?
The I see. Of two supersymmetries in supergravity contains in the right hand side.
Exactly.
Translation, but also
it could include other charges. I see what you're saying. Maybe in general you can do something extra, but for this class, this is what's going on.
Perhaps you cannot do it because it's not.
Yeah, I'm a bit dubious, but I don't have a quick answer to say you can't do it.
The vibrations are pretty long because of the twisting, right?
Yes. Yeah. So in fact,
it's only because of the magnetic.
So what I would do, I would take the R1,3 of say in Poincaré coordinates. I would replace that with R1,σg, and this topological twist would be switching on the magnetic charges onto this, and that's then manifests itself in why that's a vibration. Good. In fact, let me just say my main motivation for this talk is to give you kind of a big picture kind of idea of the kinds of things we're interested in, the kinds of calculations we've done, because the details are rather complicated. So if there's anything conceptually that's not clear, please jump in.
The near horizon geometry of the black string in ADS3, what's the
along the string direction in the radius?
So here we start with R1, we start with R11 cross sigma G, and that's the four dimensions of the four-dimensional field theory. So the ADS3 is the R11 plus the radial direction, and the sigma G has now been caught up in here. Okay, here there's a right moving central charge, and there's a central charge which we can calculate from the gravity, as Mark, who's here somewhere, maybe told us. We can obtain this, and we would like to match that side. So what I'm interested in is, in this program in here, is calculating 1/4 G2 and C supergravity. And ideally, using that as a diagnostic to identify or relate it to a field theory calculation and thereby identify the field theory. There's some additional quantities you can calculate, but associated with wrapping brains, but let me not mention that. Let's just focus on these two basic physical quantities.
So this the magnetic charge, can it be decomposed in several magnetic charges? I mean, the simplest case, here and over here, they are both constructs, right?
Yes.
You have, in the simplest case, in order to get ADS2, you need to have to work four magnetic charges.
Okay, so this has a canonical asymmetry Killing vector? But a particularly interesting class, which I'll hopefully get to at the end, is when this has U1^4 symmetries, and the magnetic charge can be charged with respect to all of those. And that's the R symmetry twist which you need for supersymmetry, and then some extra global symmetries you can twist as well, as an optional possibility.
So you have choices of how many of these?
You can switch them all on. For every global symmetry, you can switch it on. But supersymmetry requires that there's a certain R-symmetry twist to make sure that supersymmetry is there. One thing which I should mention is, so I told you that this, by definition, is a magnetically charged black hole in ADS4. The actual black hole solutions that are known are very few. So there's many of these that are known, but the actual black hole solution is not known. And that's an interesting open question of how to construct those or prove that these really are the near horizon limit of a black hole. There could be obstructions. You come up with a solution like this, but there's no way to glue it on to an asymptotically ADS4 space. So generically, I think that'll happen, but it's an open issue.
Right, and that's related to a question I wanted to ask again. How is B varying? Does that describe the entire evolution from the near horizon all the way out to the asymptotic?
No, so B is just a scalar function that depends on these coordinates, and it's bounded.
Okay.
I'll say a little bit more about B later. Okay. Maybe that might become a bit clearer then. I want to calculate these two things from the geometry. And by the geometry, I mean from this data here. And we're going to get that by a variational principle. So the goal is to calculate these from a variational principle from the geometry and relate it to a variational principle from the field theory. So what the hell is going on there? If you haven't seen this before. Let me just tell you or remind you that field theories with R symmetry have some interesting properties. So if you know the R symmetry of supersymmetric conformal field theories, you know quite a lot about the theory. For example, if we're n equals 1, d equals 4, like this story here, then there's something called A maximization. So the A central charge is a function is determined by the R symmetry, and moreover, you can obtain A by extremizing a trial A over a choice of trial R symmetry directions. So you have a field theory, you You have a bunch of asymmetry. You have a bunch of symmetry directions, and then you construct an asymmetry as a function of those symmetry directions. You extremize this function, and at the extremal point, you get the acentral charge and the critical asymmetry. N equals 2 in D equals 3. There's something called F extremization, where, slightly differently, you ask for the free energy of the three-dimensional field theory on the three-sphere, and you vary that over the space of asymmetry directions. And at the critical point, you get the critical asymmetry, the free energy. Let me just... So this is an old story. What does that mean here? So these are the two cases I've just described there. So this one, if you're considering ADS5 Christosaki Einstein 5, the acentral charge turns out to be proportional to the inverse of the volume of the Sasaki Einstein 5. That's just a fact. And for ADS4 Christosaki Einstein 7, the free energy on S3 is proportional to 1 over the square root of the free Sasaki Einstein volume. So what are these field theory extremization problems in terms of geometry? Well, the first point actually is worth highlighting, is these are on-shell solutions, and I just read off what these physical quantities are. So what does it mean to do a variation principle to get them? It means you've got to go off-shell in some way. But there's no canonical way that you can go off-shell. So you just have to invent something and see if it gives you an interesting and useful mathematical structure. So Martelli, Sparks, and Yao did that. And what they said is, they said, consider going off-shell by not thinking about Sasaki-Einstein, but just thinking about Sasaki metrics. And what that corresponds to in terms of this cone definition I gave you is if this is Sasaki, then the whole thing is Kähler. So you relax, remember Calabi-Yau's Kähler and Ricci flat, finishing first term class. What they say is, relax the Sasaki-Einstein condition by just thinking about Kähler cones or Sasaki metrics. And then what they showed is that the volume of Sasaki-Einstein metrics is a functional of the space of Killing vectors. And that is what you would expect from this field theory point of view. There's some physical quantities which are function of R symmetry. The R symmetry is dual to a Killing vector. So the geometric extremization problem is take volume of these spaces as functionals of the Killing vectors, extremize that, and at the extremal point, you'll obtain the Sasaki-Einstein metric or the Calabi-Yau cone metric. So, any questions on that? This is 15 years ago, a very well-established topic, and there's definitely more to say. But if you haven't seen this, you may have some questions. Okay, so there is this abstract extremization problem, geometrical, and it was actually extremely useful in building up the dictionary between the field theory and the geometry. It's not just some nice thing. It was actually very useful.
Sorry, could you clarify how... So we have a bunch of Sasaki metrics.
Yeah.
With various U1 symmetries, right?
They may do, yes. Yes, exactly.
They have only one U1 symmetry.
But in general, they have a bunch. And then...
If there's only one, then you cannot apply this. So it's important that you have several.
And there's one thing I'm not telling you, which I didn't want to get into, but, I mean, obviously if you just extremize this volume, you think, well, why doesn't it just shrink to the minimum be the zero volume? You actually, the cone has a holomorphic n form, and you fix the charge of that holomorphic form to be 1, or to be some fixed number. So that's fixed, and then you do the variational on the remaining ones.
What do you mean by a function of the Killing vectors? If I have a load of metrics,
So one way, which I'll come to a little bit later, is you might have One way in which you can think about these geometries is there's a particular class called a toric class, and they have four U1s here and three U1s there. And then the Xi is literally a linear combination of those U1s. And then you could, it turns out that, and it's not obvious, that the volume itself can be expressed purely in terms of that choice of a vector. Yeah.
So the manifold is always the same and you're varying the complex structure? Or whether?
No, you're keeping the complex structure fixed.
Okay. So,
and you're just varying the vectors inside the choice of
the vector. Why varying the vector is varying the manifold? You said that if we go to a Keller manifold,
because I didn't want to. maybe I can continue a little bit. They're good questions. Okay, so this is an established story. And what happens if you go to the case we're interested in? So if you go to 2,0 in D equals 2, then Bernini and Bobev show there's something called C-extremization, which is much the same principle as this one. There's a central charge, and you extremize it over the choice of R symmetry. And for the quantum mechanics, actually there isn't a general statement. However, so that's an interesting point. There isn't a general. It's very suggested that there is, but we don't know what it is. For this particular class, where you take the field theory, you wrap it on a Riemann surface, and so on, they said, Bernini, Hristov, and Zaffaroni said, calculate the partition function on S1 cross sigma g, and extremize this quantity over the space of R symmetry directions. And moreover, if you extremize this quantity, it should give you the black hole entropy at the extremal point. Okay, so the goal is to try and give you a flavor of what we've done here to find geometric analogues of these guys. So let me keep that there.
So extremizing over the R symmetry directions means you put some chemical potential for the R symmetry and extremize over that chemical potential? Is that, what's that?
This one?
Say this S1 times sigma.
This one. So this is some trace minus 1 to the F, e to the minus beta H, e to the I, j, a delta. And these are some chemical potentials for some conserved quantities. And you vary over the space of the deltas. So yes. Okay. So let me now go back and tell you what these geometries are, because I've just said that they're a metric, a scalar, and a twofold. But let's be more precise about that. So the first thing is you can write down an action. Which looks like this. The details don't matter at all, but I'll just put the factors in. So it's just a theory of gravity in Euclidean dimensions, with a kinetic term for the scalar field and a kinetic term for the Maxwell field. And then there's some, the scalar is just appearing out the front like here. Of course, you could rescale the metric if you like, but this metric, this is a Ricci tensor for this metric as written there. So if you vary this action, you get an Einstein equation, you get an equation for the scalar, and you get an equation for the Maxwell field. If you solve those, then you found solutions of D equals 11 and 2B. That's just a fact. One way you can think about where this came from, we didn't do this, but it will be equivalent, is if you did a dimensional reduction from D equals 11 on ADS2, type 2B on ADS3, you would get down to a 9-dimensional or a 7-dimensional theory of gravity, and this would be the theory of gravity. Okay, so that's where the equations of motion come from. But we want supersymmetry. And you can pursue the same kind of ideas. This implies that there's killing spinners. And I'm not going to tell you what those killing spinners are. Instead, I'll tell you what the consequence of those killing spinners are on the geometry. So the first thing is there exists a killing vector. And that was sort of guaranteed by the fact that this had to have an R symmetry. So a canonical killing vector should appear just geometrically from the killing spinners. It has norm 1. And we can define a dual 1 form. So for example, if some local coordinate psi is d by dz, we can define eta as to be dz plus p, where p is not a function of z.
Norm
1 everywhere in the manifold.
That means you have a circle of constant size everywhere?
Yes. So I'll write down in a sec what we have. So ds squared, so the metric now is eta squared plus, there's one catch to what you just asked. So it turns out you can write the metric in this form. So this is the one form eta squared, and this is the transverse space. And this turns out to be Kähler. So the complex structure squares to minus 1. There's a Hermitian metric. So when you lower index, you get a 2 form, and that 2 form is closed. That's Kähler. And we can define the Ricci form, whereas you take the Ricci tensor. And you hit it with a complex structure. That turns out to be a 2 form. It's called the Ricci form. Okay? And interestingly, the full metric and the solution is fixed by this Kähler metric. So what do I mean by that? Well, eta, this one form I just told you about, the twisting piece, this p, d of p, is just the Ricci form. The scalar, e to the b, is the Ricci scalar, we should call it 2n there, of that Kähler space, which means that we better have that to be positive. So Kähler metrics with positive Ricci scalar is what's going on here. And the final bit of data I need to tell you about the solution was the 2 form, and up to some factors which I'm not being precise about, it turns out to be this.
Sorry, if e to the b in front of the metric that you've written is the Kähler metric, so the Ricci scalar of the piece without the e to the b is itself e to the b?
The Ricci scalar of this is e to the b, yes.
And then you scale it by another e to the b.
Yeah. So, I mean, all this comes from manipulating the killing spinner equation. So yeah, it's convenient to take that factor out so that this metric is Kähler. And then it turns out that there's actually an R there, but it's not too important. So if you have a Kähler metric, then you have all this data. So you have this, 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 and this. And so then you have your full solution. So that's kind of nice. But this is just supersymmetry. We haven't imposed the equations of motion yet. So we also need to impose that delta S equals zero. So you can write down all the Einstein equations, et cetera, et cetera. Most of those are actually implied. Supersymmetry implies most of the equations of motion, but not all of them. And what you're left with is one more condition on this Kähler geometry. And it's the Laplacian acting on the Ricci scalar minus the half Ricci scalar squared minus the Ricci tensor squared. And the fact you're seeing a nonlinear equation and things involving r squared, this has nothing to do with higher derivative gravity. It's just we're doing ordinary leading order gravity. And it's just the fact that the way in which we've packaged the problem together, this is what you find. So to say it another way, if you can find any Kähler metric that satisfies this equation, then you have found a solution to 2b or d equals 11 of this form. And this is precisely how we found explicit solutions back in 06-08. And now this looks pretty nasty. But I'll give you a very simple way in which you can construct solutions. Imagine that this Kähler space was a product of Riemann surfaces. And those Riemann surfaces are each Einstein with a behavior like that. Then this Kähler metric, the Ricci scalar of the full metric will be constant. So that term drops out. And then these terms are just going to be some quadratic relations involving the lambdas. So a product of Riemann surfaces with different radii can solve this equation by just solving some algebraic equation. So there's a very concrete way, and then you're off and away, and you're constructing these solutions explicitly. And there's more sophisticated things you can do, but that was what we did back in 06 and 08.
Jerome, isn't there a sign between the two? Otherwise, it's positive definite. I don't see a solution.
I think I've got the sign right.
The box R is equal to zero, and then the other stuff is positive definite. You mean the R state?
Sorry, yes, you're quite right. Sorry, so you're saying. One of these signs is different.
There's two conventions for the Laplacian, so you're right.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Good. But we're not quite done. It's almost done. But the last thing you need to do is you need flux quantization. So we may have to make sure that G4 and F5 are suitably quantized. But that actually turns out to be kind of nice. So it turns out that this is the condition for flux quantization. So what's going on here? Let's just take n equals 3, for example. So this is the type 2b one. This is just the two form, which is a two form, which is one form, that's a five form. So integrating that over, in this case, a five cycle should be an integer. And that's the quantization of the five form. N equals 4, you would get a four form here, six form, seven form. That would be the quantization of star G over seven cycles. So your goal is find Kähler metrics that solve that equation, and then impose this condition on the fluxes. Okay, good. Just like I indicated for the Sasaki-Einstein, what we want to do is go off-shell. So I want to set up a variational principle, so I don't actually I mean, this is all very well for finding explicit solutions, but if you want something more abstract, where you can relate a variation principle of the geometry to a variation principle of the field theory, we want to take this off shell. And the way we take it off shell is very simple, and turns out to be useful, is we keep all the conditions for supersymmetry. So we keep all of this information, but we drop that we're solving the equation of motion. That's not actually quite true, so that's dropping this equation. We actually keep, to go off shell, so we keep the supersymmetry, drop delta S equals zero, but actually we drop this condition, but we actually keep this condition. Okay, so what is this condition? It's rho squared, the Ricci scalar squared, the Kähler form, and the one form. If you unpack that, it's actually the integral of this equation. So we keep the integral of that equation, but we drop the local version of it. And as I said, this is not in any way canonical. There's no reason why you should do this. You just have to try and do something that's useful. And this is what we did after playing around, and it is useful. So our off-shell geometry is we keep supersymmetry, so we keep a lot of this information. We impose this, but we drop this local condition here.
So that you're kind of finding the avatar of doing this field theory extremization.
Exactly.
But in as much as it makes sense in the field theory, is it possible to just use the dictionary? This whole logic of C functions built in the stress tensor.
I don't know how you would do that. Just because, I mean, ADS-CFT is sort of not such an on-shell thing. I mean, you're given your geometry, it's an on-shell quantity. So you've got to go off-shell.
Well, but I mean, it reproduces, well, aside from current discussions, it reproduces everything about the field theory. Everything that's valid to do in the field theory should have some. Maybe that's just what you're doing.
Yeah, there. But I suppose if you go too far off-shell, then you have nothing to do with the field theory. So you've got to keep some ADS-ness somewhere. I think there's probably a better answer to what I'm saying, because this works, and this volume minimization works, and I think there should be a better answer, but I don't know what it is. Okay, so in fact, we're kind of close to just finishing sketching the point, is when you do this procedure, go off shell like this, then you can ask, so for these off-shell geometries, you can ask what the action looks like. And it turns out to be something very nice. So this is this action here. So this action here with all these terms. If you demand all of this structure, which is a lot of structure, then it turns into another one of these integrals. And if you look at closely what I've done, I mean, they're all just slight variations. This is one rho and n minus 1 j's. This constraint was two rows, n minus 2. The flux quantization was one rho, but there's an n minus 2. So they're all similar at that level, but all slightly different. So that's what the action is. And this is just a functional now of the choice of Killing vector. Because if you choose the Killing vector, then that chooses, makes the choice of the eta. So, yeah. Your question, Johan, is going to come back again, but let me address. I think at this level, I just want to continue. So, this you can view this as a functional of the choice of a Killing vector xi. in a sense that if I choose the killing vector x I, that will give me an eta, and that will split the space like this. So that is the a flavor of Eva was saying, the avatar of the extremization principle and the field theory in the context of this geometry. And if you extremize S, let's call it S Susie, then you can find that the supergravity action is the on-shell value of this action, for the two B solutions, and one on 4G2, black hole entropy is some other number times, again, the Susie on-shell action. Okay, so just to summarize, there's a way of taking this geometry, taking it off-shell, and then setting up a variation problem such that when you go on-shell, you precisely recover the central charge of the dual field theory and the black hole entropy for the case of the ADS2 solutions. So in particular, this is obtaining the black hole entropy via a novel variational principle on these internal manifolds, which I think is just generally an interesting observation. Okay, for the last few minutes, I want to just indicate how this is useful. So this looks all very abstract, and it's like, at best, the extent that it seems to make sense, it just looks like it's so abstract it's kind of useless. But let me give you a flavor of how it's powerful. So, and I've mentioned this a few times, so I think I've rubbed it off now. So the special case, a special case of the special case, so let's take the Y9 that was a fibration over the Riemann surface. That's the ones associated with black holes. And the Y7, that's a Sasaki-Einstein 5, fibered over the Riemann surface. That's associated with the black strings. And let's take these to be toric. And what does that buy you? Okay, well, toric manifolds, let me just focus on this one. The Calabi-Yau cone has three U1s. So this Calabi-Yau 4 would have four U1s. And given all the nice structure of Calabi-Yau geometry, you can associate a polyhedral cone. Let me just draw a diagram. Something like this. So this, what I'm drawing here is meant to be a representation of this geometry. And you take a cone, and it's labeled by a series of vectors that are inward-pointing normals to the face of the cone. So in this case, we have a bunch of them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five vectors fixing this polytope, and they are integer-valued. And moreover, this data, a very nice thing about this data, so this is a three-dimensional polytope, and we're looking for a six-dimensional manifold. So the picture you should have in your mind is there's three dimensions there, and there's three U1s, so a three torus. So at each point in this space is a three torus. And these vectors are telling you precisely which U1 in the T3 is vanishing as you come along to each facet. You just think of a two-sphere. There's a line. And each point above the line, there's a circle. But when you get to the north and south pole, the circle is shrinking in precisely the right way to be regular. And here, we have a three torus. And these vectors are saying which of which circle in the T3 is shrinking the right way to be regular here. So this is a whole mathematical apparatus that's been well developed. But these vectors are telling you lots and lots about the geometry. Okay, so in our context, say we're interested in black holes, magnetically charged black holes with horizons that are the Riemann surfaces, and the fiber is a toric, it's a cycli-Einstein 7, all these black strings, and this was a toric SE5. We go and deploy all of that extra structure here, and the nice thing is that this becomes algebraic in the Vs, in these vectors which determine this toric geometry. So what that means is that you can take a Sasaki-Einstein, for example. If it's toric, there's a dictionary which tells you what the quiver gauge theory is. So you know you have the four-dimensional field theory in your hand. This procedure gives you something algebraic in the Vs. Then the extremization principle then can be cranked through, and then you'll get an answer for the central charge. You can then do field theory extremization using the same, because you have the quiver gauge theory, you can just do field theory extremization, and those things agree exactly. So for the case for these ones, there's basically a one-to-one correspondence between the field theory calculation and the gravity calculation. I see that. I just realized that people can't see that. Okay.
Jerome, in the previous step, when you went, I didn't follow exactly why you went off shell and then back on shell again.
So the idea was, so on the field theory, there's a way in which you take your trial central charge as a function of all your global symmetries, and you vary amongst those global symmetries to pick out the R symmetry. So on the gravity side, if you're on shell, you just have your Killing vector. In the story, it's just given to you directly by the Killing spinners and that stuff. So the idea is, you go off shell geometrically in a small way, and then allow your choice of vector to vary inside that manifold, and that should be the analog.
The goal wasn't to find the final answer, it was to match the intermediate step.
It's to match the intermediate step, that's not a proof in a sense. I mean, it's sort of like in spirit. There's a field theory extremization problem, there's a geometric one, and once you've got them, then deploy them for any specific example, and that's where the real matching to say that you've identified the field theory will happen. So take a four-dimensional field theory, put it. Yeah, okay. Let me say it. So what would you want to do in practice? For example. So if I started with a Sasaki-Einstein 5, and I tell you that this is toric, and then this will give me some n equals 1, t equals 4 quiver gauge theory. And then I take that four-dimensional quiver gauge theory, and then I put it on a Riemann surface with a twist, and then I use C extremization just in the field theory language to get a central charge here. That's just purely a field theory calculation. And then what I've been saying over here is that these, if we wrap it on the Riemann surface, there should be an ADS3 across, let me write it this way, just... an ADS3 cross Y7 solution where the Sasaki-Einstein 5 is fibered over the Riemann surface. I then deploy all of this extremization structure I was telling you using the toric data, these Vs, and then I'll get an answer here. And these will be functions of the magnetic charges that we've put on the Riemann surface. And these agree. So So this is almost a complete proof of, so given these types of geometries, this identifies what the field theory is. It is this quiver gauge theory reduced on a Riemann surface with certain magnetic charges switched on.
Wait, so you didn't have that statement already from the brain construction or something?
No, I mean, it's heuristic. And moreover, there's subtleties. So this is not quite a proof. So in specific examples, you can just see it working. Specific examples, I mean, just like in Einstein 5, it's T11 or YPQ or S5 or various things like this. But there's one subtlety, well, there are at least one subtlety, which is that these extremization principles don't guarantee you have existence of solutions. If there is a solution, it's going to give you the right answer, but you haven't shown existence. So there can be obstructions. Certainly on this side, it's easy to imagine obstructions. You take a gauge theory, you put it on a Riemann surface, and it just doesn't flow to a conformal field theory. So you go through this procedure, you might get a central charge, but there is no field theory. Usually the diagnostic here is that the central charge is negative, or something like that. Over here, geometrically, the extremization principle is giving you the right answer provided there's a geometry. But we know cases where that geometry is obstructed. So the open issue for this class is exactly finding necessary conditions, sufficient conditions for those obstructions. And that may be a very hard geometrical question and possibly field theory question as well. However, the big picture is that sort of there will be the exception to the rule. And then the same thing happens if we replace this with ADS4 cross Sakai-Einstein 7. And now we have this three-dimensional quiver. And now we have, we get a quantum mechanics here.
So I have a remedial question. In the field theory side, how is it, what is the fictitious space? There's some fictitious space of theories where you don't know what the R symmetry is, but you can compute the central charge.
Yeah, so typically the way these work is you'll realize the field theory by a flow from some UV theory. So in the UV, there'll be the R symmetry, which you know exists, and there'll be a bunch of other global symmetries.
Yeah.
And then you just construct a linear combination of all those global symmetries and say, that's my trial R symmetry.
In the IR.
Exactly. And then you calculate the trial A central charge, or C central charge, or whatever it is you're interested in, as a function of that, and then vary over the space of choice of all those
variables. Yeah,
global symmetry, sorry.
How do you do that step? How do you calculate the central charge as a function of the R symmetry?
So you have some matter content, and you know what the charge of all that matter content is in the UV. In terms of, so you have a bunch of global symmetries, and you have some matter content, and you know how everything's charged under all the fields. Sorry, how all the fields are charged under the symmetry. And then the R symmetry then is just a linear combination of those, and A is something like trace R cubed minus trace R, or something like this. So you take the trace of the R charges of all the fermions.
Oh, okay.
And then you have then you have something that's a function that depends, well, it depends on the variables. So R is some linear combination of, how do I want to write
it? But that calculation is in the UV.
That's in the UV.
Is there some idea that has a correspondence to the off-shell gravity?
Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. That's a variation on Eva's question. That might be a more natural way to go off-shell. To somehow relax the ADS condition, which I didn't do at all. So you might have thought, in this big story I'm doing, just make this R and this just R11, and then the radial direction gets caught up in here, and the radial direction gets caught up in here. And now, so you've relaxed the conformal invariance, and you're trying to somehow flow to the conformal fixed point. So I think that's a very good idea, but I don't know. I don't know how to do it. But that would, I totally agree, that would be the most natural way to go off shell naively.
So can you phrase this computation of A in terms of turning on sources for your partition function on the S3 or whatever it is?
This thing? So this is
this A is a
so this is a function.
This expresses as a functional with like an S3 partition function with sources for.
So A is the this was the D=4 central charge. The D=3 story was that you have a partition function on the 3 sphere. Yeah. Okay, so I think I'll just wrap up.
I'll ask you later. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The big picture is that these are an interesting class of geometries. These are particularly interesting because they're associated with black holes, the near horizon limit of black holes. And through this geometric extremization principle, we now have a way of identifying which black holes these are associated with, and matching the entropy with an index calculation on the field theory, and matching these to the entropy of black strings using C extremization. There is many open issues. I just hinted about one about obstructions, is like this procedure works, providing there really is a field theory in infrared, and providing there really is a geometry that exists. So what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for the existence of these solutions? That's probably a hard maths question. What's working here beautifully is any time these spaces are toric, but not all Sasaki-Amazigh manifolds are toric. So we pretty much have nothing to say about the non-toric case at the moment, except there's very abstract, something very abstract, that there is a geometrical principle at work, but can you actually use it effectively? I've also been focusing on this fiber class because it's associated with something naturally you can connect with a field theory you understand. But these geometries don't have to be fibered. And if they're not fibered, there's no Riemann surface in there. They're not in any way obviously connected to four-dimensional or three-dimensional field theories wrapped on Riemann surfaces. So we pretty much don't know what those field theories are. And finally, in terms of black holes, all of the black holes I was discussing or referring to were magnetically charged. So there's this Riemann surface and there was magnetic charges on the Riemann surface. But there's also electrically charged black holes and there's also rotating black holes. And I haven't discussed any of that in this formalism, but perhaps it can be incorporated as well. So, there's certainly a lot of open questions still remaining. Thank you.
Are there further questions for Jerome?
So I have a question. I couldn't quite understand the level of matching. So this is exact. So you get log of some number of an integer.
Yeah.
In the 2D case.
Okay. Yeah.
And is that expected? I mean that's. It doesn't rely on some large n limit.
Everything is large n.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, I see.
Everything's large n because I'm looking at this at just purely the leading gravity level. And how much of this survives beyond leading n? I'm not sure.
Okay.
So in particular, this partition function that Christoph Bernini and Zaffaroni looked at, it's only, I mean, so they calculate that partition function, then use localization to express it in terms of a matrix model, and then evaluate the matrix model in the large n limit, and they get an answer. And it's that final answer which I was matching to. But what's beyond that is again, well, I maybe they have some ideas about it.
You imagine you could do that localization in Gravity.
Yeah, that's a thought. Yeah, possibly.
Further questions?
Could you do anything with the stationary rather than static?
Yeah, so that would be the case when we have rotation. And that's a great question. I don't know. So the near horizon limit won't be exactly of this form. So the question is, what is it? And does any of this nice supersymmetry structure still carry through?
Exactly.
So we're thinking about it right at the moment. So it's a good question.
Okay, let's thank Jerome.
Thanks.